And for several years, I've been working on some concepts and some relationships, basically the question of the relationship of Christianity to questions of resources, energy, pollution, population, and some of those related questions. I've sort of carved that area out as an area of specialization, though I teach a number of other things. I have been doing some work on a new book to follow up on the one I wrote some time ago, which Mary told me to announce is available in the bookstore. Mary, I filled your wish. And basically, what I want to talk tonight about is a vision of the future. In Winter Program, which is, for those of you who are guests in the village, Winter Program is a group of 20 people, men and women, here at the village, who are studying various things. And I have been working with them on some energy ethics, and John has been working with them on questions of lifestyle. And the thing that we have not really looked at is the question of what is the overarching vision or goal for which we change lifestyles or live any particular way of life. And tonight I'd like to offer such a vision of the future, which I will call, and this is a rather awkward title, the Just, Participatory, and Sustainable Society. Why I call it that, I will explain. We could call it a whole number of different things, but that's one that the World Council of Churches and the National Council of Churches have been using in much of their work. So I'll start this, and I'm going to basically the outline of what I'm going to say is as follows. I want to make a few introductory remarks about the changing assumptions in the last 10 years in this society of ours, to look at three problems which have forced us to reevaluate our directions and our assumptions, then to describe what I'm calling the Just, Participatory, and Sustainable Society, and talk momentarily about the need for visions in all societies, and finally conclude with a, if I have time, with an analysis of the choices it faces. I think we can say about the last 10 years that it's been a time of dramatic shift in basic assumptions. In fact, it's been profound in the history of the United States, I believe, and this era will be looked back on as a quite a shift. I don't know when the era began or when it will end, but we are in the midst of it, there's no doubt about it. It's like riding a car on a superhighway that has come to an unsignaled end. And one could call it the end of some stretch of the interstate highway system, you know, one of those ends that they have construction beyond it. Now, in this case, just a few years ago, just yesterday, it seems that everything seemed normal on the highway. Nothing indicated the changes that were about to occur, or at least nothing we were aware of the high speeds of travel. The road was smooth. The way was well marked. The landscaping was a little brown, perhaps, from the exhaust of so many automobiles. But we didn't notice that too much as we proceeded along at our 70 miles an hour. The eight-cylinder engine purring away, running smoothly, fueled by a recently filled 20-gallon tank of very inexpensive gasoline. In those days, it was just an effort to keep down to 70 miles an hour. Everything seemed to conspire to lead to a future of ever greater technical progress. Now, to say that the superhighway of our assumptions has come to an unsignaled end is not entirely accurate. There were signals along the way. We did reduce the speed limits from 65 to 55, though my last run on Interstate 5 indicated to me that not many people were obeying that change. And the way of our assumptions does go on. It doesn't end here. We can't stop time. But something has happened to our assumptions. Our assumptions have been called into radical question. We don't know what to expect. We don't know whether the superhighway will have 6 lanes or 4 lanes or 2 lanes or maybe no lanes at all. We're not quite sure whether it will be pavement, it will be gravel, or be a wagon track. There's a series of choices facing us, and all this leads to us to raise great questions about who we are and what our assumptions are. Now, this analogy of the superhighway is not meant to be a prediction. I'm talking about our basic assumptions that are called into question. Indeed, Americans may face deteriorating highway systems. They may crumble. We may face reduced standards of living. Such an eventuality is only one of the possibilities it faces, however, and we could imagine other kinds of future in which the cornucopia of technological progress, or the cornucopia produced by that progress, will continue. I guess it's conceivable, very conceivable, that if we try to overcome the future with new technologies, that we may, I say may because I'm not sure, we may be successful in that. On the other hand, we may as a society elect to pursue other less economically oriented ends, such as leisure or conversation or art. The analogy of the superhighway, then, is to raise to view changed ways of thinking about basic assumptions about who American Christians are and what they're doing. It seems to me, and it's my own opinion, that the wide, easy way of economic growth, of technical progress, and of heavy consumption of material goods has come into serious question. And the things that we passed at high speed yesterday are now causing us to take a second look. And the road to the future is not quite so open and so smooth, at least not as Americans consider the implications of present direction. Now, there are three, it seems to me, three basic problems that have caused our reevaluation as Americans. Some are old problems, and some are new. And the way I want to get into the first is by using the board here and to illustrate this graphically. The first of the problems is negatively called limits to growth. I say negatively because it suggests that there something negative is going to happen. There are limits to what we can grow. And positively, I think it's stated as a problem of sustainability. How can we sustain a society with some level of consumption over some indefinite period? Now, I'm going to use some analysis here that is very simple. Some of you have probably encountered it before, and some of you probably have not. It can be stated very simply, and I'm using this analysis to get into this, not to suggest there's limits or something with this, but to point out two of the problems, two of the basic problems that have caused our basic assumptions to be called into question. Now, this graph that I have here is a graph of what's called exponential growth. Exponential growth is how your savings accounts grow at a constant percentage of itself. We can have all kinds of illustrations we can use of exponential growth. The famous illustration of the man who asked his employer, the employer asked the employee whether the employee would rather be paid for 30 days by paying him a penny a day the first day, and 2 cents a day for the second, and 4 cents a day, or whether the employee really wanted the employer to give him a million for 30 days. Well, the fact is that if you double a penny every day for 30 days, you end up with about $11 million. Very significant amount by the last day, but it takes quite a few days to build up to that. That's an illustration of exponential growth. Exponential growth begins at a very low quantity. It doubles a low quantity, continually 1, 2, 4, 8, etc. But then after a while, it takes on, the slope of the curve takes on a very steep slope, like thus. Now this is down on the bottom part of the graph, is time, years, days, in this case years, and the left-hand side is quantity, any quantity you want to measure. Now, there are a number of quantities in the present which are growing exponentially, or have been up until recently. The growth of the population is now growing at a rate of about 1.6%. That's world population, fortunately down from a rate of about 2%, which means a doubling time of about every 45 years. The population of the world will double at present growth rates every 45 years. Obviously, that cannot go on forever. There are limits, you say, to population growth. The consumption of resources has been growing until recently exponentially. The consumption of energy until 2 years ago in this country was growing exponentially. In fact, some rates, like the rates of electrical consumption, were as high as 7 and 8% for several years. Pollution, at least, was thought to be growing exponentially, though the calculations or the statistics on pollution are very inaccurate, so we can't tell. There's some indication that that's slowing down. But for 10 years ago, at least, all those factors were growing at what we call an exponential rate.
Now, there's a problem with exponential growth like this in a finite world. It cannot go on forever. There are limits. And I've arbitrarily drawn this line in as a limit line. And we can see some of what I call the treachery of economic growth, of growth of certain things, not just economic growth. But it's, again, I want to be clear at something. I'm not talking about all forms of growth, but selected forms of growth. There are certain kinds of growth, such as lectures at Holden Village, such as this one, that can go on growing forever. And the speakers can go on talking forever. I'll try not to do that today. This is the limit. So where this crosses this, the quantity that's growing can have to stop. There's a finite limit. For example, if you're consuming oil and gas, and there's no more oil and gas in the ground, you've reached the limit. Now, the treachery of it is, under this thing, is that you go from a half a limit to a full limit and a doubling time. T1 to T2 is a doubling time. From here to here, it takes that much time. If the doubling time is 45 years or 35 years or some lower figure because of a higher rate of growth, you're going to reach that doubling time in a very rapid period of time. You're going to be halfway from half the consumption to the limit in a doubling time of a very short time. There's an interesting fact that we've only consumed 15% of the world's oil so far of known reserves. 15% of all that's been consumed. What's the worry? We got 85% left. Well, doubling time, current doubling time, that means the supply is about 30 years, the current growth rate. That's how treacherous this thing happens. And social change doesn't usually happen that quickly. So you go from half a limit to a limit in a short time, and the society that made itself dependent upon energy or anything else that you're looking at growing, and the safest limit is putting itself in severe jeopardy over a very short period of time. Now, this isn't any kind of iron rule of logic that you're going to run into limits. Many people think that there are limits, that we are going to bump into them very soon, that we better change our activity immediately. There are other people, however, who point out that through technology, modern technology, you can in fact increase the limit. Now, how does that work? Well, basically, you find new sources of oil and gas, for one thing, or you find substitutes. That's the biggest reason for people saying that you can avoid limits is by substituting one thing for another. In terms of energy, so we run out of oil and gas, modern technology will develop fusion power, and we will avoid the limits that oil and gas are facing us with. So what we in effect do is move the limit up to twice the amount of energy. Well, that's fine and dandy, but if you continue to grow, you really only have another doubling time of 35 or 45 years before you run out of what you doubled your supply of. And many people say you can't keep doubling and doubling and doubling. On the other hand, there are people who say you can. Now, this business that I'm talking about here several years ago became the basis of a very famous study called Limits to Growth, a computer study put out by a group of computer specialists at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And they said that technology will not solve the problem. And they ran that through the computer, and guess what happened? Everything ran against limits. In fact, what all the computer runs discovered was that it runs into a limit, overshoots, and then collapses. When a population collapses, that means starvation. When energy collapses, that means a shortage of gas, new gas lines. But all this collapses. The opponents of the limits to growth pointed out that if you program in that all the bad things grow exponentially and all the good things don't grow exponentially, you've already programmed your computer to produce the solution. It's the old computer maxim, garbage in, garbage out. And so this debate goes on. Now there's a question. Will modern technology, as we know it, push these limits back indefinitely? Now that's a factual question, and a very important factual question. Unfortunately, we don't know the answer to that question. And so there is in fact another question being asked. It's not a factual question, but a value question. do we want it to happen? The question of sustainability I'm submitting here is not just a question of physical, factual limits, but a question of who we are and who we want to be. I have, as an ethicist or as someone teaching religion, don't know whether we can continue to grow. I do have my opinions about the value question, about whether I want us to grow, because I think that there are some severe questions about who we are that are raised in a constant need to expand certain forms of economic, certain forms of energy and power, and certainly population growth is a constant worry as well. So there's two questions, a value question and a factual question, and in this debate over this limits to growth, these two are constantly confused. So, the first problem that's causing questions about our assumptions is, can we or can we not do this? If we're running along on a superhighway at 70 miles an hour consuming fuel, it raises very serious questions about whether we either should build those highways or if we should be traveling at 75 miles an hour, or a third, we should say whether we should be using that gasoline at all for traveling along that highway. So the first question is the question of limits to growth and sustainability. So the second question, and this is an equally serious one for me, certainly maybe even more so, is the question of modern technology, and I'm going to label this question the question of participation. Well, I'll make that clear. The first question is that of sustainability. The second question is that of participation. It seems to me modern technology raises a very serious question. The ability of people, not the ability, but the degree to which people can participate in modern systems. And I, for the sake of discussion here, I'm going to divide that into developed countries and less developed countries, or third world countries, whatever name you want to use to talk about that split. There's no satisfactory term to cover that split. In a developed question, the problem with technology seems to me to be the growth of large, complex systems. Not just technically complex systems, but large organizations. And it's part and parcel of the whole technological process that large organization goes along with sophisticated technology. It requires a very large team of experts to devise, design, produce, and then market modern technologies. This requires a very large expenditure of money in most cases, a very large organization to manage. With the coming of large organizations, we have the problem of outsiders participating. With complex, sophisticated technology, we have the problem of people like me understanding. I don't understand the spaceship that's going to lift Planemia into the stratosphere. I mean, whoever does that. I don't understand much about what's going on in the flyby Saturn. I can read the unsophisticated accounts in Time, but I can't evaluate whether we could have a space program or not. I really don't understand much about that. There is a lack of participation in comparison to many traditional societies where on a local level there is considerable participation of people in communities. What I'm suggesting is that we have a problem, and it's one that's raising questions about our assumptions about whether technology is progressive, that is leading to a more full life. And I'm raising questions that, at least at the level of participation, that is raised some serious questions, at least in my mind, in the present. And I think the movement towards sophistication and size basically is anti-human. I would at least submit that for discussion. It's more ambiguous than that. I'm oversimplifying, but I think we have to raise questions about that today at least. In third world countries, the problem is perhaps more, is not quite as easy to see, but basically it's the importation of large, sophisticated, not even sophisticated, sometimes technologies into a basically agrarian traditional society. The type of technology you elect has something to say about the values that you're going to hold and the type of social structures you're going to live with. And if you import modern sophisticated technologies, you're going to change social structures and values. In many third world countries, this means rather renting changes from traditional societies to modern industrial society. Now, I'm not quite so sure that change from a traditional society to a modern society is good or bad. I guess I have to leave that to people in the third world countries because I can't decide that for them. But I would really like to raise the question that whether you, really ask that question of those people if they really want to undergo that change from one society to the other. It certainly produces certain economic goodies, but the question about the change in values and the values that you have to have with an industrial society. And I really think that the values do go along with the machine. I think, and if you can't have one without the other, then that becomes a very serious question for people in the third world. But they also have the question of whether they are participating in the importation of these technologies. There's a further question of participation in the mines. Those technologies are coming in often because of our aid programs and the work of multinational corporations, and frequently the people who are receiving them are neither asking the question or have very little choice in those technologies. So it seems to me the participation is then raised on that level as well. The third problem is the problem of social justice. It's an old problem. Nothing new here to change any assumptions we've had, but the question of social justice isn't so much one of us being rich and them being poor, though some of that, but it's the degree to which our wealth and our consumption habits actually impact the level of poverty in many third world countries. And that impact is there. I'm not going to try to say that the multinationals are ogres, or every time you consume, you're leading to the starvation of a child in Uganda or someplace like that. These problems are very complex, and I'm really only touching the surface of them. But it is true that our companies and our government and us, by our consumption habits, do contribute. And there are people in this room who have seen that more vividly than I have. Basically, it can be done in any number of ways. Corporations who have profit as their way of doing things. I mean, that's the animus of corporations. That is, they try to buy beer and buy cheap and sell at a high price to get high profits. And that's not always compatible with the needs of poor people in the third world. For example, in many countries in Latin America, you have the anomaly of prime agricultural land being used for cattle, for the production of cheap beef, hamburger meat, which comes to the United States, and people on the farm or nearby are put out of work because of the mechanization of one sort or another, or because that meat is being shipped to the United States and they're not getting it as food. So while we get lower prices, in many cases there is a malnutrition in areas which are exporting food. And that's just one illustration. We do this all over the place. Questions of social justice. And social justice is not just that kind of impact, but also our level of sharing with many third world countries. Our level of aid to countries of any kind is rather low. I mean, it's dismally low. Something like, well, I don't know what it is, how you measure these things, but one thing I've read says we're 13th out of 14th, no, 17th out of 18th, and per capita giving, which does not suggest that our levels of sharing are particularly high. Okay, I don't want to belabor these problems. I'm really covering the surface of these. But the three problems, then, that faces are the question of sustainability or limits to growth, the question of participation, and the question of justice. Now, to move into the second part or the third part, whichever, however you're counting, the Christian Forum that has been addressing some of these problems, perhaps more than others, is the World Council of Churches. A lot of work's been done in the World Council of Churches. Starting in 1966, there was a significant change of interest or direction in the World Council efforts. Prior to that, it had been pretty much a Western industrial-dominated organization. But in 1966, there was an effort to make a commitment to hearing the voice of people in the poorer countries of the world. And during the 1970s, the Council Section on Church and Societies undertook a series of international conferences dealing with what they called faith, science, and the future. And from these conferences emerged a vision of a future society, which is awkwardly, as I've tried to suggest, but accurately called the just, participatory,
and sustainable society. It's this vision of the future that I've been attempting to do some work on myself. And let me attempt now to outline that vision of the future, and I'm going to write some things down for you just for the sake of clarity. This vision of the future, the just, participatory, and sustainable society, has three main components. One, I'm just going to call it an economic component. Second, we must attend to the questions of the political structure. And third, the questions of value underlying that structure. So it's a vision of the future which has some concrete details to it. The economic order first is clear and broad outline, but vague in particulars. All visions, it seems to me, and I'll say a word about visions in a minute after I've completed this vision, all visions should be vague. They shouldn't be blueprints, because the nature of vision is to stimulate kind of thinking and direction rather than to be detailed for planning and directing in detail. It seems to me that the economic system that we're talking about should have four basic goals. The first goal should be the provision of basic human needs. By basic human needs, I mean food, housing, clothing, and some margin above subsistence. Subsistence is food, clothing, and housing, but there needs to be some margin above subsistence. So the goal of some sort of long-range, just, and sustainable society is one in which basic needs are provided and there is some margin above subsistence. And this is to be maintained over the long haul. The second function of the economic system is to reduce the inequalities of wealth, income, and power. And that's an ethical need. We can have sustainability with very unjust and unequal shares, income and wealth shares. But it seems to me if we're talking about Christians and there's a concern for the poor, which I'll talk about under values in a minute, then the economic system then has to provide for a more equal distribution. The third goal of this economic system would be indefinite sustainability with regard to population and the consumption of energy and resources. Now, you can have lots of people living at a very low level. You can have few people living at a fairly high level. There's a trade-off between population and consumption of energy and food and a number of other things. Hopefully, we will be able to stop the population growth we have in the world and to live at a fairly high margin. But in any case, we need an economic system to provide us energy needs and other hardwares over a long period of time. And so the fourth category is one of environmental soundness. It has to be in keeping with basic ecological support systems, the basic systems upon which all life, not only human, but other forms of life must depend. One could call this, and I have elsewhere called this, the equilibrium economy, because basically what you need is an economic system and basic equilibrium with natural support systems. Now, it doesn't mean that this economic system would be one without economic growth. Many people want to poo-paw or to deprecate notions such as this because they think that all forms of growth will cease, will have nothing but a stagnant, dead-end society. Only the kinds of growth which cannot be sustainable, that is, forms which have limitations because of the finiteness of the planet, would necessarily be eliminated. The growth of non-polluting, non-depleting forms of economic activity would go on and even be encouraged. There's no reason why we want a society with very low levels of consumption. With time and increases in technology, there certainly would be rising standards of living, hopefully. But there are certain things that we'll have to do. We'll have to increase durability, recycling, the elimination of waste that now is so prevalent in our society will have to be eliminated. It seems to me that local self-reliance and participation in communities on local levels will be very important in participation in production decisions and and other decisions for the community, because it's been just demonstrated time and time again that dependency and non-participating systems are not very productive. We need productive systems. This is not going to be a system without production or anything like that. New technologies would also be encouraged, but unlike past, we would have to carefully tailor our technologies to our goals. There is a tendency now to allow technologies to go in any direction. Very common are called the tunnel vision. Technologies are conceived on a very narrow range, and frequently their implications or side effects are not even considered. We really have to consider the side effects. Impact statements of all technologies will have to be very important parts of this society. Now, particular attention in this would also have to be given to what some people have called soft or appropriate technologies. Soft technologies are associated with the name of Amory Lovin, a Friends of the Earth representative in London, England, who has been writing considerable amount on this. By soft technologies, he means technologies which are oriented to end use. For example, you don't need a nuclear fire to heat hot water in your hot water tank. The term appropriate technology is one associated with the work of E.F. Schumacher, and it means technology designed appropriate to, again, the project that you are undertaking. You don't need a heavy tractor in a third world country where you have a 2-acre plot, or you don't need energy consumption and sophisticated technologies for many of the tasks that human beings undertake. Appropriate means also, it seems to me, technologies which are smaller in this day and age and ones which are much less energy consuming. That is to say, less energy and resource intensive and tailored to local needs and end use. Okay, this gives you some direction about this economic system, the goals, and a few of the particulars. I'm not going to spell this out in any greater detail because I'm really trying to give you an overview of this tonight. The political system, the second element, and while crucial, is also problematic. The basics of a necessary political system, it seems to me, are clear enough. Beyond the normal functions of political units, by the way, those are often overwhelming in themselves, and I don't want to easily say we can go beyond those. The very management of a society is itself precarious. We sometimes take for granted the fact that things function, and we get all uptight about our society for its injustices. But the mere fact that an economic system functions and allocates and distributes at all, there's something to be said for a system, however badly it may do it or however unjustly. So political systems will constantly have to face the questions of freedom and order and so forth. But this political system has extra pressures put on it because it would have to maintain or manage some sort of worldwide sustainability, reduce inequalities, work toward local self-reliance and participation, and find alternatives to the arms race and war. Now, obviously, that's quite an agenda, and I'm being purposely utopian here and suggesting that that can even be managed. But if we were going to have a sustainable future, we're going to have to move in those directions. And it remains a rather open question whether this is beyond human capacity. Now, what kind of political structures would meet such a challenge? Well, some form of centralized power would be necessary to manage sustainability and conflict, and to maintain some sort of rough equality. Resources in the world are not distributed equally, and if we didn't have some sort of central authority to distribute, then each of the local areas would turn, the rich ones would soon become richer, and the poor would become poorer, and you'd be back in the old mess again that we know well enough in our present society. But the problem with centralized power is that, and we all know the problem with that, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So you run the risk in a centralized power of reducing participation, of increasing tyranny, and making local communities irrelevant. So I'm really pointing this out as a problem because of government in this kind of worldwide sustainability is one that I don't see the answer to yet. Many people who have thought about this, William Ophuls, who wrote a book, I've forgotten the name of it, he comes out very strongly for a very fairly authoritarian kind of system. And I would hope that we could develop a political system that can manage sustainability in a way that's open, democratic, and participative. That at least is the goal. That at least is the vision. Whether we pull that off, I'm not sure. Now, the political difficulties that I have been talking about here would be markedly reduced if we had a new ethic or a new value to go along with this whole thing. Certainly, the values that are prevalent in American society today will not work in anything like a sustainable society. They are not of the nature that would be attuned to this. We have a very strong ethic. I don't want to go through all the values. That's another evening in itself, the values that really animate the society. But they are fundamentally invariant. The achievement ethic, the emphasis on growth, on efficiency and pragmatism, many of these values, while good, I'm not going to deprecate them, are not really compatible with long-range sustainability. We really need a set of values, and I think already we are beginning to see some changes in the direction of values which are more compatible with this question of sustainability. So Christians, at least, it seems to me, the worldview or the values which underlie anything that we're talking about must be based on biblically derived assumptions. And I think we Christians have a lot to say about the values that would be important in such a society. This will all come into in just a second after I've outlined a few of the values which I think are going to be important in this situation. Secondly, the values and the worldview that would come from them, would lie underneath these values, must modify our current assumptions and values, especially those which have contributed to the three problems that I've outlined already. Now, of particular importance here would be, again, coming back to these three problems, suggest three kind of overarching values which would be important in such a society. Question of social justice, a value of participation, or at least affirming the and seeking the participation of as wide and as great a number of people as possible. And the third value would be long-range sustainability and the economic values which would have to go along with that. Now, below these three values, it seems to me we could talk about a whole number of other guidelines or values. Proficiency in the winter program, we've talked a lot about enough is enough, questions of proficiency, questions of limits, instead of seeing kind of unlimited expansiveness of human beings, though I don't want to eliminate that completely, to combine that kind of unlimited reliance, not reliance, but unlimited sense of which we can create. There has to be a sense of that there are limitations to life. It seems to me that the emphasis upon community would have to be one that which we have neglected, and it has to be essential to the values of such a society. We've already talked about the question of appropriate technology. It seems to me this notion of appropriateness is a very important value in and of itself. We don't need always bigger. We need different sizes. Some bigger, some little, some in between. And so the direction of appropriateness now, if we talk about that as a value, it seems to me towards smaller. But the word appropriate is very good because it points to several different sizes. Another value would be renewability. It seems to me we have to take sources of energy, for example, which are renewable. And I'm pointing to questions of particular things like solar energy, perhaps fusion power. We don't know for sure whether the fusion of hydrogen atoms is possible to harness, but that would certainly be a direction for technological development. And it seems finally that some sort of renewed value which places much higher emphasis upon the intrinsic values of nature. That can be done in a number of different ways, but the utilitarian view of nature, which has pursued us for several centuries now, seems to me has to be fundamentally altered. Now, I want to return to this question of the Christian contribution of this, because it seems to me that's what interests us as Christians. And there will be a special value to this, the values of the worldview underlying this vision that I'm drawing here. It seems to me among the most important are the Christian understandings of sin and repentance. It seems to me the notion of sin leads to a fundamental understanding of limitations. There are limitations to human society. There are limitations, it seems to me, to the technological process to develop constant solutions. There are limitations to consumption. Sufficiency is a norm which proceeds out of this understanding of sin and the limits of human beings. Furthermore, the Christianity talks about a concern for the poor. It's in Exodus, God hears the voices of suffering, it liberates the slaves from Egypt. It's reaffirmed in the prophets, to whom justice, care for the poor, and for the orphans and the children are central themes. And it again appears in the teachings of Jesus Christ, who in Luke particularly talks about the acceptable year of the Lord, the Jubilee year, but more than that, talks about the liberation of the poor. Constant theme, one of the most important themes in the whole of the Bible, which leads us to affirm justice, but justice as a particular attention to the underdog and for liberation of the underdog. Furthermore, it seems to me that the call of Jesus Christ and the Apostle Paul to sharing in community, not only in community, but in the worldwide community, and their warnings about the dangers of wealth and possessions. Another fairly constant thing in the teaching of Jesus and Paul. It's not possessions per se that are opposed by Jesus and Paul, though in some of the teachings of Jesus there is a tendency to throw off possessions completely, not only a tendency, but there is that example. But the basic biblical witness isn't against possessions per se, but the wrong use of possessions and the degree to which they have a tendency to take us over and become idols, something that we worship, something that we need or depend on instead of on God. Beyond that, the early Christian emphasis on small, holistic communities seems to me is important too. Paul in Romans 12 is a very beautiful description of the life in community. The description of life in the early community in Jerusalem in the early part of Acts. Though it's very utopian and perhaps not possible for us to realize the kind of total sharing like that, at least points to an ideal in Christianity of small sharing communities. And it seems to me that's something about what Holden has tried to be about. Another thing would be the Christian notion of stewardship. Christians have been accused of having a rip-off ethic because in Genesis they are told, not just Christians, but to mankind is given dominion and told to subdue the earth. There is some righteous complaint against Christians and Jews at that point because we have indeed taken, I don't know if it's because of that or because of our own greed, have taken order to have dominion and subdue and have done it very literally in a very rough way. But in the biblical message, it's quite clear that that is not the way, that that's really a sinful human appropriation of nature, that basically what's talked about is a careful stewardship, that we care for the earth in the same way that God cares for us. And that puts an entirely different dynamic upon relationships with nature and on care of the earth than a kind of rip-off ethic that it seems to me at least partially animates some of the things we're doing. And finally, not finally, but I'm going to draw this section to it, by saying that at the center of all this, it seems to me, is the question of faith. It reiterated that time and time again in Winter Program. John reiterated things that I had said earlier, that without the relationship of faith to God, in which we receive God's love and respond with our love, that any kind of question for Christians of a sustainable society or of justice or participation seems to me almost impossible, because faith does animate a kind of love and justice, and without that, without that dynamic in us, we have a very strong fight against the problem of our own greed and self-centeredness. It reiterated that time and time again in Winter Program. John reiterated things that I had said earlier, that without the relationship of faith to God, in which we receive God's love and respond with our love, that any kind of question for Christians of a sustainable society or of justice or participation seems to me almost impossible, because faith does animate a kind of love and justice, and without that,
that because that without that dynamic in us, we have a very strong fight against the problem of our own greed and self-centeredness. And the basic message of Jesus is the message of faith. The kingdom of God is at hand, repent and believe in the gospel. That's the dynamics of faith. We receive God's kingdom or God's community. The teachings of Jesus are very interesting things, even in the teachings about the community, about the kingdom of God, about levels of community. It starts small. It happens unexpectedly. It comes like a thief in the night. There's a whole number of characteristics that Jesus has about the kingdom of God. It seems to me talks about community and the responsiveness within community. Repentance is a change of way, change from self-centeredness to openness. And finally, belief is not just articulation or statement of creed, but a full responsiveness to the love which we feel in the coming of the kingdom, which is partially here. It's this kind of basic essence that seems to me forms the for Christians, the basis of any kind of change for the future. Now, I've talked long enough perhaps. Let me just say finally a word about vision. This is a vision of the future. This is not what's going to happen. I would love it to happen, but this is not what's going to happen, obviously, because of human sin. Visions, on the other hand, still are important. Even though they're not going to happen the way you want them to happen, visions are important because, as it says in Proverbs, without visions, people perish. We need visions to give us direction, to stimulate us. The function of visions is not their realization, but to act as a stimulator, a bringer of the kingdom to us. Teaching is that the vision of a just, participatory, and sustainable society is a vision of what God is calling to us. It's a tentative embodiment of the kingdom of God. I say tentative because there's no human society that's the embodiment of the kingdom of God. But if I think, and if I have one person's opinion, it seems to me that this view of the future is as close as I can come to imagining what God is calling us to in the kingdom at this time. And such, it gives us direction, this general direction, and stimulates us to some sort of activity. And that activity is not just changing personal lifestyles, that's important, but it's also efforts along on a social level. Concern for the world poor, concern for the structures of your own society, and so forth. The vision then is to animate us. We have choices before us. I could outline these choices, but basically the fundamental choice, it seems to me, is between, as this original diagram pointed, raises the question of do we want to pursue the society of the future and sustainability, in fact, at this point, through technological fixes, through efforts to overcome the future by manipulating it with technology, or whether we want to reconceive the future and proceed along a direction of sufficiency, of care of the earth, and attention to human community. It seems to me that there's a fundamental difference in these two paths, and that is the question which really faces us today. And these paths are divergent at this point. And our assumptions, the technological solution really allows us to make great change in assumptions. But the path that I'm suggesting here requires a fundamental change in assumptions. And that, I think, to me, is what faces it. Okay, I'm going to quit at that point. Maybe there's some discussion or questions. Been a very general outline that I've been presenting tonight. Certain presidents have been known to make some very strange choices once they're in office, but I wouldn't rule out the other possibilities. I would say, just fundamentally, the direction that we're going right now is quite clearly in the direction of technological solutions. And if you ask me basically how I think the outcome is going to be, is that I'm not pessimistic, I'm very realistic about the realization of what I'm talking about here. It's a vision, not something that I really expect to happen. And I'm talking about my reading of the empirical situation, not my hopes and my, you know, the fact that I think that God may be present and may be leavening this lump. But given my view of the past, is that I would suggest that the direction we're heading in is away from what I'm suggesting here, very fundamentally away. In some respects, it raises very interesting questions. See, I don't know whether we're going to have limitations, but I sure hope we do. That's a funny thing to say. I don't know whether we will, but I hope we do, because I don't think we're going to deal with the problem beyond the question of sustainability, which may be solved by technological systems, but that's not going to solve the question of participation and justice in the society. Not at all. And so it seems to me that the chance of dealing with those questions of justice and participation will only come if we're forced to deal with it. And the only thing that I see us forcing us to do that is some sort of running into limitations. So I kind of hope for those. I like gasoline prices. Not because of the deprivation they cause, but because it causes us to question our assumptions. And until we do that, we're not going to make any fundamental change. We'll flow along with the easy path.